You're listening to Beyond the Melody, a podcast that dives into the myths of musicians, artists, comedians, writers, and pretty much anyone who craves to be creative. My name is Brian Mello, and I'm a singer-songwriter from Hamilton, Ontario. I know how unforgiving an artist's journey can be, but I also know that inspiration can come from just about anywhere. I'm sitting down with people who know how to dream big. Let's explore their impact and how it's even bigger. Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Beyond the Melody. On today's podcast, I have producer, songwriter, and lead singer of melodic rock group Harum Scarum, Mr. Harry Hess. Harry, what's up, brother?
Hey man, how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I was telling you earlier, coming into the studio here, I'm getting like a rush of memories because my Truth album, I was able to record here, and you produced it. So it's been a lot of fun to come back here and experience like the old memories, right? When you started producing, it was pretty early on, right? Didn't you have a studio and stuff before Harum Scarum?
Yeah, I mean, they've always gone hand in hand for me, you know. Yeah. So basically, I thought if I'm going to write songs, be in a band, I want to learn how to record them, like even for the sake of demoing them, right?
Yeah.
So back in that day, it wasn't so easy just to, like, you know, turn on a computer and just record an idea or throw an idea on your iPhone or something like that.
Right.
So you'd be dealing with all kinds of, you know, specific equipment to multi-track anything. So you could have a cassette tape where you'd throw down an idea, but the minute you wanted to get into like multi-track recording, that was a big deal.
Right.
So yeah, I got into that super early when I was like 14, 15, as well as, you know, starting to play in bands, starting to write songs. And it's always gone hand in hand with whatever I'm doing, is that I get into recording. And then I really, really got into recording. Once we made our first record, I started working with Kevin Doyle, who at that point was, you know, at the top of his game. He just finished, you know, making the Alanna Miles record, I think, sold like 10, 12 million records.
That's
worldwide.
Crazy.
It was one
that,
of the number one records. He just, you know, worked on some Hall & Oates stuff and Kiss and things like that. So he was definitely an engineering mentor for me. And then after that, I really got serious about learning engineering and mixing and all that stuff. Yeah.
Looking back now, though, you know, with all the ebbs and flows of this fucking crazy industry, how vital do you think it is that you now had that studio to fall back on?
Yeah, I mean, it was very valuable, only because, you know, not only do you get to network and learn from working with other people and other bands, which would never happen if you're only living in your own head and in your own world and working with the same, you know, three or four people that you're in a band with, it can be kind of limited to the growth that you experience as, you know, not only a songwriter, but as an artist, because whenever I would sit in a room with other people, even if I'm just engineering their record or making their record with them, I'm always learning something by their approach or what they're doing or getting exposed to songs. And then, you know, working with other producers along the way, you would see how they would, you know, manage even a session or manage artists or work on songs, or what they thought was a good idea and what it was a bad idea, how to approach recording, like from a technical perspective, you know, like different miking techniques, how people mix, what kind of outboard gear are they using? Why are they doing it this way? So I got, you know, the luxury of just working with, you know, bands. And then because Harum Scarum at one point was doing pretty good, you know, we had, you know, major label budgets and we could work with, you know, talented people that had success, and they were a lot older and more experienced. So that was amazing, you know.
Always
a great learning experience.
I know. And then the acts that you've had come through Vespa here have been freaking amazing. Are there any acts that sort of just like floored you as far as like the talent goes? I'm sure there's a ton, but
yeah, I mean, there's been tons. I mean, as far as the Canadian music industry goes, I mean, I think we've specifically in the rock genre, we've done a lot of rock bands here, and you know, some weird anomalies, like, you know, over the years, like people would just come in out of town or whatever like that, and they just happen to be in Toronto. And so, you know, they would come in and do, you know, a one-off or a recording or something like that. But, you know, some of the traditional Canadian rock bands, like I bought the studio from Arnold Lanny, and at that point it was already a studio that had a lot of success, not only with him as an artist doing, you know, Frozen Ghost and stuff like that, but the first, I think, three Our Lady Peace records were done here, which was, you know, Clumsy's one of the only diamond-selling records from a Canadian artist in the history of the Canadian music industry, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a big deal, and that was done here. And he'd done some Finger 11 stuff as well in here and a bunch of other bands, you know?
I remember you telling me, I think it was Jim Cuddy. Didn't he come in here and he sang Bulletproof?
He didn't sing it here, but I mixed that track here.
Yeah, and it was then, like a one-taker or something like
that.
Yeah,
that's right. And then, that's what
son of a bitch.
That's what I was told. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, getting to work with, you know, artists like that, it's amazing because they're super talented and, you know, amazing at what they do. And then being a part of it is super cool. And if it goes on, has any kind of success or longevity where people kind of remember the track or whatever it is, or the band goes on and does something, that's always cool. But yeah, like in the rock world, I mean, yeah, we did a bunch of big rock records, Ian Thornley, a bunch of Monster Truck records, if not all of them,
yeah.
You know, Arkells, Billy Talent, 3 Days Grace, and all kinds of stuff. So, and on and on and on, like, you know, so it's been going on forever. Yeah.
Hey, man, that's good. I mean, if you look at, like, especially where, like, the studios recordings have gone, fuck with technology and just, you know, just putting it on your laptop and trying to come up with these budgeted albums.
Yeah.
A lot of these studios just fucking couldn't survive.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that for you guys to be able to sustain and also flourish within that time is kind of an anomaly, right?
Well, I mean, like, you know, back in the day when I started, this would have been considered a small studio, and then it turned into kind of like a mid-level studio, and then it turned into a big studio because I actually had a recording console, and it was an acoustically designed room. Like, this place was designed by Westlake Audio, you know, 30, 40 years ago when there were no studio designers in Canada. So hiring a top LA company to come to Canada to build the studio would have been a big deal, but only affordable 40 years ago. If you had to build this in today's dollars, just with lumber and, manpower alone, it would cost you millions of dollars to do 2,000 square feet into a properly designed acoustical space. So, and then, you know, you put in the equipment and all that, and it's just not doable anymore in 2021, or even necessary, quite honestly, you know. So a lot of people have had to figure out a way to record on their own, and I think the people left doing this are people that are pretty self-sufficient and can get, you know, their own creative outlet over the finish line in some way, shape, or form. Because if you were reliant on a team and a big budget, those people kind of fell off the map, like maybe 10, 15 years ago. I noticed that transition of where I was working on major label budget stuff. And then I would every once in a while run into like a producer that I would be working with. And some of them were so old school that without the team, they wouldn't know what to do, you know, like even Pro Tools like eluded them, right?
Really?
So they couldn't hop on Pro Tools and jump in there and, you know, kind of be a part of the team. They were just the producer that sat back on the couch and would weigh in on opinion and not to play down their role. But I'm just making note of the transition for, you know, a lot of those people that were old school that relied on that big budget and the team and the space and the whole thing coming together. And then it turned quickly. And now I think to the point where producers like are working on their own in their own space. And then they bring in artists to come in and sing on the tracks that they've put together, either for them or with them.
Yeah.
And that's what it's morphed into over the years. And and so there's a lot of really talented producers out there doing a lot of the heavy lifting, should I say.
Yeah,
a lot of these records. Yeah.
But I remember that too. There was a few producers out there that would literally walk in, they would lay on the couch, Mm-hmm. Say, yeah, that's cool. That's mm-hmm. good. Get up, go for a smoke, and leave for another 10 hours.
I'm or be on the phone or hang out. I'm like,
wait, are you producing this record?
That's right. And, you know, they would have an engineer. They would have an editor. They would have a team of people in the room that they trusted to get the record done.
Yeah.
And that was really normal back then. You know, there was just enough for everybody to kind of have a team involved. And that just, it's few and far between now.
Yeah. Well, man, you know, I remember I grew up listening to Harum Scarum and watching the videos, and I'm pretty sure that for a while there you probably had the best hair in rock and roll.
I think so too.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, who's competing with that?
No, nobody.
But my brothers were really big fans of yours, and it was playing around the house, you know. So when I got the chance, and I remember my manager said, like, you know, we have an opportunity to work with Harry Hess. That was a really big deal for me, you know?
Great.
So,
yeah.
So that was awesome. But, what was the inception, to Harum Scarum? Cause I know you were with a band before that, right? But, how did that all come together?
Well, again, like, I was really interested in songwriting, and I thought that that's what I was just going to do. So, you know, after my first band that I was in a metal band when I was a kid, you know, literally 15, 16 years old. And I made a record and it got released on Attic Records. So I had my first record deal when I was 15 years
Blind
old, technically.
Vengeance.
Yeah. And it was pretty much over by the time I was 16. At the ripe old age of 16, I was washed up. And then I thought, oh, you know, like, I'm really into this recording thing, but I like songwriting as well. And I never wanted to be a front man. I never really wanted to be the singer in a band, but I guess I could do it to a certain extent or level. And so I always put in the effort and time, because if you're writing a song, you have to translate it somehow to somebody.
Yeah.
And for me, I guess, you know, I had to be able to sing it. So I would start singing on these demos of these songs, but I kind of came in through the publishing side of it, where I would hook up with publishers where I would play my stuff for publishers. And I just wanted to do more songwriting.
When you were 16?
16, 17, and then 18. And then I, you know, just had written enough songs. And then, you know, the natural progression was just to be in a band back then. Like, there was just a time where everybody that was into music or writing songs or recording, you were in a band. And that was it, right? So we did that. But the band just kind of recorded. That's all we did.
Well,
and then
was,
we started playing.
I was going to say that. That's what I thought was interesting. You guys actually kind of did it a little different than most.
Where it's because that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to record. I didn't really care about going out and playing live, to be honest.
Really?
But then everybody, like, once you're in a band, everybody else really wanted to do that.
Yeah.
And then we started doing that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after about a year, which felt like forever at the time, but when you're 19, a year is a long time.
Yeah.
We got a record deal with Warner, you know, and then we put out our first record. So that came out, you know, when I guess I was 20 or 21 at the time when our first record came out with Warner. And then we just kept going, and we were one of the few acts to ever finish our record contract with Warner. I think it was us from Blue Rodeo. We're the only ones. We did 7 albums for Warner, and then we kept going even after that, just putting out records independently.
You did 7 for Warner, right?
We did 7 albums for Warner, and then we've done, I guess we've done...
You've done about, what, 15?
Yeah. 15 studio albums.
Yeah.
And then with live records and B-side collections and all that stuff. It's well over 30. It has
That's
been
crazy.
For a long, long time. Yeah, because we started having a lot of luck in Asia, specifically Japan. And in Japan, they would love new material all the time. So this started when we were on Warner. They would say, look, if you want to put out a record every 6 months, we're fine with that, which was a weird cycle to be doing.
Wow.
To be making records, writing, recording, touring, and then doing it in 6 months. You know,
how do you
it was
do
nuts.
That?
We kind of didn't. It would take about a year. But even then, like, you know.
A turnaround in a year.
Yeah, nuts. And we did that for forever.
Fuck, how do you even get time to write?
I know. Yeah. So we were really churning them out, and it was my full-time job just doing that thing. And then to boot, sometimes I'd even be working on other people's records at the same time.
Crazy, man.
Yeah. So the schedule was pretty nuts. But when you're young and you have the energy, you just do it. And so I did that. And like I said, then we did indie deals around the world, you know, starting from Japan and then Europe as well. So we had a record company in Japan that did all of Asia. And then we had a record company in Europe, in Italy, that did all of Europe. And then we'd just do some small licensing deals for South America and stuff like that. But, you know, it was pretty cool. I mean, you know, not a lot of artists that started off in a major label that got to make so many records and continue to have a career under the radar like we did, and then went on to do it independently and still continue to
be successful. Right?
Yeah, we built up a fan base on a on the back of a major label. I always admit that and say, you know, we did it at a time where you could do it. But, you know, there were times in Japan where we'd release a record and it would, you know, we would do 50,000 pieces in the first day.
That's crazy, you know,
in Japan.
Well, how about like with like the impact of Mood Swings?
Yeah, because I mean that was the second record
for us,
and that broke us kind of internationally, and got us, you know, on our first record we had like three territories, and Mood Swings we were like well over, like we were like 50 territories,
and that was one of like the top like rock records in Japan for a while.
Yeah,
right?
I think and Kerrang, I think that whatever year it came out was the number one rock record in you know, it was a Euro magazine that was a big deal, and still to this day, I mean, it bothered us actually for quite some time, because when you're putting out new material and all anybody ever wants to talk about was that thing you did, you know, before.
Yeah.
It just felt like it was a slap in the face to the new material we were doing. But in retrospect, it was our their introduction to us. And like anything nostalgic. People kind of hang on to it and they go, oh, I was like 15 when I heard this, or I was 20 or whatever. And they love it. And it's full circle now. We're obviously very grateful that we ever had any success on anything. So it's pretty cool that, you know, to be liked or remembered for anything.
I could see that, though. I could see that in like the beginning stages. It's like you're already kind of, you know, treating me like this, like icon artist has been.
Well, our third record was so different from Mood Swings that it was a backlash, and we didn't realize it at the time. We went pretty dark and esoteric, and we didn't realize that, you know, the landscape had changed in North America a lot, where I thought, you know, this is fine, it's okay, you know, if Nirvana and Alice in Chains are like on the radio, it's fine that we do something a little darker and heavier. But we didn't realize that our core fan base was really into something more melodic and light. And they liked us for what we did on the first two records, which, again, in retrospect, makes total sense. But when it's
hard to ride that line, though, too, right?
Yeah, and like, you don't really care, to be honest. Like, because if you're an artist and you're making records, you're like, well, I know, like, so I'm going to do something different. So big deal. Like, why would that? But you don't understand that when you build a fan base and they like you for doing a thing, they want you to do that same thing over and over again, which isn't... there's no longevity in that. There's no way that any artist is just going to make the same record over and over and over again and people just accept it and like it. Like, you can't really have a career doing that for too long. So as an artist, you just want to keep growing and doing things differently. And as you do that, that arises the issue of like, okay, well, do you just cater to your fan base and make the same record? Mm-hmm. Or do you do what you want to do, grow as an artist and make different records? Well, eventually it stops working and bands stop making records and it ends. So for us, doing this 30 years later and still making records, quite honestly, we're catering to our fan base. We're making the records that they want to hear and that they want to, you know, they expect from us. When you buy a Harum Scarum record. And I've come to peace with it in the last 5, 6, even 10 years, where I go, I get it now. Where before I didn't get it. It took me a whole lot of years to wrap my brain around it. But it would take that long, you know, of where you just kind of give into the idea and go, picture being a fan of something.
Yeah.
And they put out a new record and it's nothing like what you like about them. That doesn't work.
Totally.
It doesn't work for me and it wouldn't work for them. And so the minute I could understand that and then move forward and make records, understanding what our fan base or, you know, people that like us and why they like us and what they expect from
us.
And now it totally makes sense to me now.
Yeah. It's like, I heard, Sylvester Stallone, saying that, where like there was a moment there where he was trying to do dramas and trying to do comedies and stuff. And it's like, well, dude, we just want to see you kick ass and blow shit
you're
up.
Rambo.
You're Rambo. You're Rocky. Yeah. You're that guy, and you do that well, right? Yeah. And I can get in. You know, there's a moment there as an artist and you're trying to be creative where that can be frustrating.
Yeah.
But at some point when you get a little less precious with it.
Yeah, that's right.
And fall back into it, I could assume that process gets more enjoyable.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And for an actor, I mean, ultimately they're pretending, you know? It's I kind of wasn't, you know? I really was making an attempt at doing something different and believing in it. And then at the end of the day, when that gets rejected and people just want you to do what they loved about you in the first place, then you have to come to terms with the fact and go, hey, how lucky am I that there's a bunch of people around the world that, you know, if I do something that they think is what, you know, they want to hear from us, that they're going to support it. And that still goes on to this day.
That's amazing.
You know?
Yeah, you guys were in Manila not too long ago, right?
Yeah, we actually did our first show in the Philippines. Yeah, maybe like 4 years ago, which is weird because that was our first gold record ever, was in the Philippines.
Really?
In like 1991.
And just never got out there.
We never got out there. I mean, it's tough to travel.
Of course.
And make it work financially, you know? And we did so well in Japan that was easy enough to do. But, you know, in smaller countries where, you know, it's just not that simple to just hop on a plane and travel with a crew and a thing and put on a show. And And again, we were lucky enough that we did well in pockets of Europe that it was sustainable. So, you know, what you'll see a lot of bands from Canada or North America do, you know, they'll do the festival circuit in Europe, right? And so, you know, you get a bunch of good anchoring, you know, festival dates, you get paid really well, and then you can go out and do a few weeks, if not a couple of months after that, in some smaller territories in Europe. Yeah. So that was our move, and still, you know, before COVID was our thing. I mean, we were booked to do Sweden Rock Festival right before COVID. And then, you know, so we'd go do Sweden Rock Festival, I think, Guns N' Roses are headlining it this year or whatever that. And it was always, you know, a great thing to do, but we'd never done the actual Sweden Rock Festival. We'd been to Sweden and did, you know, a bunch of shows on our own, but those things were always cool. And so we could always like jump on to something in Europe where the UK was always a good one for us. We would go do these festivals in the UK and then, you know, end up hitting all the other smaller territories.
Yeah.
And
was it awesome. Was it the UK festival that sort of like that period where Harum Scarum parted ways for a few years? Was it the UK festival that reached out to you and it was the 20th anniversary
Mood Swings? Yeah, of the Mood Swings record. And so,
in some sense, is that how you guys decided to come back to it?
Yeah, and continued making records after that point, because I was just engineering at that point, producing records, and got into that side of it. And I was having a good run, you know. I was I was doing records for, you know, lots of, you know, things in Europe that were quite honestly just great paying gigs and cool things to work on. Mm-hmm. You know, I was working on like X Factor and The Voice in Europe before they were even out here in North America. And so that was a really fun time in my life and really cool. And did a lot of projects for Sony. And then it branched out into, they kept giving me other productions and stuff like that to do. So there was a good like 5-6 year period where I was just going over to Europe and making records over there with European artists. And that was all cool. So, you know, I enjoyed that part of my life too. And then, you know, you get it called back, you get tugged back into this world of like, you know, hey, remember that thing you did a long, long time ago? Well, we would like you to do that again. And, you know, you're like, oh my God, really? So we put together, you know, a little bit of a, you know, a show to go do this festival. And then it turns into, well, we would offer you some more dates. And then it turned into, I think we did 20 something shows in, I'm not joking, 15 countries, 20 shows in 15 countries in Europe.
How was the jet lag
on that
there?
Tour? Fuck. Yeah, nuts. I mean, you know, finish a show, 2-3 in the morning, you get back to your hotel, literally up at 5-6 to the airport and flying. There were only 3 days out of the 20 shows that we didn't fly.
Do you like touring?
To the show. No, I mean, not anymore. I mean, you know, it's fun when you're young and whatever. I don't mind going somewhere, doing a show, and then doing a couple of countries where it's just easy routing and then maybe just hanging out there for a week or so afterwards. But it's just never, you know, it's really hard to plan those things, right? Because if you're going to put it together, it's dumb just to go over and do a show or two. So it just makes sense to make as much of it as possible once you've got it all together and you're over there. The smartest thing for us to have done would have been to go to Europe and live in Europe, you know? That would have been smart. Because it would have been so much easier for us just to go and tour, constantly tour, and then be home to do our thing. Well, but for us, it was the opposite. It was always very difficult.
I love this quote that, and this it's so you, but I love this quote that I read from you years ago, and you said that you should write a book about sabotaging your career. And I think you were saying that because you said, you know, you guys resigned in 91.
Yeah.
Literally the same year where the grunge movement sort of like changed the industry.
Yeah.
And that, you know, Mood Swing should have been released a couple years earlier and Voice of Reason should have been released in the grunge movement and all these different things, right?
Yeah.
Did you still feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, we've always felt like we were an underground band doing something that was never quite right at the time. You know, we've always felt like whatever we were putting out did not fit the mold of, you know, what was happening at the time, which is odd because we were always kind of, I guess people would look at us as like a, you know, like a hair metal band or a corporate rock band or something, you know, very radio friendly or something along those lines. But oddly enough, typically those acts are doing something that's popular at the time.
Right.
But we never were. So we were kind of pigeonholed into a band that's just, you know, flavor of the month doing what's cool and what's happening. But we never were.
Never were.
And it never worked.
Right.
And so, you know, the definition of, you know, of our insanity and stick-to-itiveness was just constantly putting out new material, making records. And when you know you're going against the grain, but the weird part for us is that we were always building a fan base and they were super loyal and it was very underground and we never felt like we were mainstream anything or doing well. We had a couple singles that did well at radio and in Europe and, you know, we had stuff out on the radio and in weird places like Indonesia, Philippines, like Portugal and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, we were just kind of just oblivious to it and unaware of it, you know, until you get out there and you tour and these people telling you of what's going on in your career. It's
I remember you telling me too, because you guys opened up for Foreigner and like when that whole, like when the industry was sort of getting flipped on its head, fucking Foreigner was getting dropped from labels and like all these
super groups. Dropped when we were playing with them. Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were just, you know, they were told by the record company that
while you,
you
guys were on tour with them.
Yeah. They were signed to Atlantic and I remember thinking, well, if they got dropped, well, we're fucked. You know, like, I mean, they sold 60 million records. We've sold like nothing. And again, this is like on our first or second record at that time. So the industry was definitely going in the wrong direction the minute we started, at least for us.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, the heyday of the music industry as far as like, you know, making money and CD sales, that was all in the 80s. And then in the 90s, it just started going downhill. But to be quite honest, like there was a good run for another 10 years for any other artist that was, you know, having any luck doing this, like they would have had a good 10-year run. So when I look at bands that came out after us, like Canadian rock bands, like, you know, Billy Talent or 3 Days Grace, I mean, they did incredibly well and still to this day. But a lot of those bands that continue to do well, they have some sort of international
appeal,
success, right? Yeah, like Billy Talent does really well in Germany and pockets of Europe. 3 Days Grace do really well at American rock radio. And so, you know, it's really tough to sustain something just in Canada alone for any artist in any genre moving forward or doing it for a long period of time, because it's just, it's a... not a lot of people in Canada, spread out, like it's ridiculous to try and tour Canada from a logistic perspective, you know. You have to drive way too far to get to the next major center. And if you're in, Europe, I mean, a long drive would be like 2 hours, 3 hours.
Yeah.
We would have tour, you know, you know, we would have like a tour manager in Europe that would be like, oh, tonight is a very long drive, 3 hours. And we were like, oh, really? 3 hours? Wow. We were like, we did 14 hours from friggin' Winnipeg to wherever to get to the next place. And we did Canada like relentlessly in the beginning. And, it, you know,
what, 10 cities,
torture.
Really, if you want to do like the major cities.
Torture.
I know.
But again, when you're young and you're dumb and you hop in a van or a bus or, you know, we did it in a Winnebago a couple times even, like just nuts.
So did I.
Yeah.
So did I, man.
Risking almost, your life in the mountains. Yeah.
This is the most Canadian story ever, is I was in a Winnebago driving and almost got killed by a moose.
Right. Yeah. You see.
Yeah. We had one of those.
I've seen a few.
We were we're going to Edmonton, I believe.
Yeah.
And the rule was not to drive at night, right? Just because we knew like moose and elk were all out there.
Right.
And sure enough, we drove like 2 hours too long.
Right.
And I was in the Winnebago and I was sleeping on the top bunk over top the driver and passenger and I was fast asleep and all of a sudden I heard them yell and I woke up and they said that it was probably like half a foot away from just smoke enough and just would have crushed us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But there's touring in Canada for you, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So if you can tour Canada and survive it, then I think it bodes well for you know, doing anything internationally because it just feels like luxury beyond that.
I know,
you
know? Right?
Beyond
know.
Canada.
Where luxury. In the States, it's like you drive for 10 hours in the States. You can go to 3 or 4 major markets.
Yeah.
You know, maybe more.
Yeah, do that in Europe. You're in 3 or 4 different countries.
Right.
So it's, different ball game for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
One thing I really respect that you guys did when you guys did the re-recording of Mood Swings, I thought that was so great because Warner owned the masters to Mood Swings, right?
Yeah.
And basically you couldn't do anything with that project.
Yeah.
You have people that are reaching out to you. I just love that you guys said, fuck it, we're going to re-record this, own our music again so that we can do whatever the hell we want with it. And honestly, when I heard that, I was really surprised that a lot of other artists don't do the same.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you would need to get in there and re-record it again with, again, like without a budget and the style of productions that we did, it was pretty over the top and big. And, you know, it was always like a real band kind of sound in the sense that we're recording live drums, real guitars and like nothing, you know. We weren't just plugging in machines and like and going for it. They were all live performances and required some sort of, you know, proper recording environment to make those records back then. And then again, if we were to recreate it. So fortunately, owning a recording studio, it was possible to do.
Yeah.
But man, I wouldn't want to do it again. Like going back and just re-recording stuff. It is. It's paint by numbers. And it's also like you can't go back because even if you feel like you're improving it, you keep wondering if you're changing it to the point where people will just go, well, why did you change that? You know? So we even started like with like, maybe we'll do some different guitar solos or maybe I'll sing a line a little differently. And then when we did, it always felt wrong. And we went back to basically copying exactly what we did the first time because we kind of thought, you know what? We did it at that time and we should stand by it. We like it. And you know, yeah, maybe we could sing something differently or play it differently, but like that's not what it was. And we were recreating a record that, you know, we wanted to, you know, pay some sort of, you know, homage to and keep it, I don't know, I guess just respect what it was and what we were thinking at the time. So we just re-recorded it and made it sound exactly the same.
Yeah.
But in this case, we were able to do something with it, right? Where we were in control of making the decisions and yeah, we own that record, which is cool because that was kind of our big record for us.
Yeah. What still gives you guys the itch to continue to record? Like the Change the World album just came out in 2020, which is great.
Yeah.
Is it sort of like this couple year cycle, one of you guys, like you or Pete or somebody gets that itch and wants to come in?
Yeah, you know what? I think at this point in my life, I kind of view it as I spent my whole life learning how to do something and pursuing something that it feels weird not to be doing it or leaving something on the table that you're like, well, like, why would you spend your whole life learning how to do something just to stop doing it? It feels bizarre. But at the same time, it becomes more of a challenge because not to repeat yourself, not to just feel like you're just doing it like a paint by numbers project where you're like, oh, this is what we do. And this is this part, you know, and then we do the solo, we do the breakdown bit. And then, you know, it really does become a giant challenge. And I don't know how much more we have left in us that we even care to get, you know, to the point where we're like, oh, I wrote another song. That sounds a lot like that other song. You know, there's the slow one, there's the fast one, and there's the medium tempo one. And then it's just a different version of it. But, you know, it's a weird love-hate relationship with, you know, something that's so familiar, so easy, yet so painful and difficult to do. Because when I stare at, you know, a blank page of 10 songs and I'm like, oh my God, not again, you know, it really does feel like work, and it shouldn't. So in some way, shape or form, you just have to get inspired to want to do it. And once you get into it, it's like it's always been, like, you know, like you feel excited to get down and do the work, and it doesn't feel like a chore to sit behind the mic and sing it or work on lyrics and even put it together and make the, I always love the final product. I never regret doing it. It's always just getting motivated to do it, because there's a lot of other distractions in life as you get older. And honestly, I much prefer working with other artists for the simple reason that they're actually bringing something to the table.
Sure.
So if I work on a record with somebody else that's got songs, they've got a direction, they've got a style, they might even have a band, they might even be a band. Yeah. And I go, this is way easier for me to jump in, be a part of something, and then they move on, they do their thing. Yeah. I can bring a lot to the table with experience and, you know, being able to work on songs with them if they choose to. A lot of projects I do, I have nothing to do with the songs. I'm just helping them make a record, and I can be a part of it like that. And if you've made as many records as I have, you don't feel the need to put your thumbprint on everything and shit all over other people's work. You can respect the fact that we're making their record, and I'll do everything for you. I'll write your songs. I'll sing them for you if you like. I can play on them if you want. And I can also just sit there and do nothing.
Sounds like the Truth album. That's exactly what you did for my album.
Well, you know what? Again, like, I don't remember. You didn't really have a band, right? Like at that point, right?
No, I mean, so, I had guys I played with.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
but,
right. But when you're making records, it's different, and you want to rely on people that make studio records. Well, you're going to get results.
It's Brian Mello featuring Harum Scarum, which is great.
Sure.
Pete played on, played most of the guitars.
Yeah.
Your drummer, Creighton
would have. Again, they're all guys that would be the first people that I call if I make a record, especially that style of a record where I go, this is what we're doing. Everybody knows what to do. And all we need are songs. We need a singer. We need a direction. And the whole thing is serving that singer in the direction of the record. And, you know, people call you to do things that they feel like, oh, I heard this thing that you do that I like, and they want you to continue to do that thing for them or a version of it. So, you know, producers or engineers or mixers, they get more work based on the work that they've done and there's similarities to it. So, you know, for me, it was super easy and fun to make those records.
Yeah.
It really is, you know, and that's what you need. You need somebody in your corner that's been there before, that's done it, that, you know, it isn't a guessing game, because if you guess wrong and you finish a record and it's a disaster, it's not like someone says to you, oh, well, okay, well, here's another 50 grand. Go try again.
Sure.
You know, but that used to happen back in the day. They would finish records. There were bands that did records 2-3 times in a row. I heard Aerosmith made the same record 3 times with different producers, different studios. I mean,
I heard that with
my life.
Don Henley's solo album. It was pretty much done.
Yeah.
And then he hated it, and they had to re-record everything again. And I think it took another year.
Yeah, Danny Kortchmar, I think, produced that record. And again, like, I had a friend that knew him, and I think Don Henley said when the record was done, is that he goes, oh, I'm redoing all those vocals.
Yeah.
And Danny Kortchmar was like, what? And he's like, I can sing him it all better. I'm going to do it all again. And so he's like, yeah, go for it. Bye. You know, and he let him do it. And I think he took like 10 months and he re-recorded everything and then ended up coming back. And I don't know the specifics of what they ended up keeping and what they didn't. But I remember the story was like he came back and said, yeah, you were right. A lot of it was good and we're going to keep it or something like that. But, you know, it was a different time and different era. And when you're dealing with an artist that potentially is going to sell 10 million records, you give them the leeway or the rope to kind of do what they want to do or exhaust whatever creative, a little journey that they're on because they got to feel like they've finished and they want to deliver something that they feel really good about. So, knock yourself out. But it's not like that anymore.
No.
You know, you don't get that luxury. So, and it hasn't been for a long time. You know, budgets are tight and people come in and record. And that's why people have had to find another way to make records. And I mean, I don't like the pressure of being in a studio where the clock is running. And that's why I've always, like being in my own studio, but I've worked on lots of records with bands in other studios and it's like, we got to be done by Friday. And it's like,
I don't think I could handle that pressure.
No, it's tough.
Right?
Yeah. Really, really tough.
Yeah. So what was some of the music you were listening to that inspired you when you were young?
I grew up listening to a lot of rock and metal because if you were 13 or 14, whenever the hell that was for me, that's what was happening. It was cool to be listening to Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, and Van Halen.
You're wearing the leather pants?
Yeah. Yeah. Or a leather jacket, at least. I don't know about the pants. I don't think I ever went that far. Probably did on occasion. But, really, I was a product of my age and my surroundings and what was happening, in music and the world in general. Like, that was on the radio. On rock radio. Like you could turn on the radio at night or whatever on Q107 and listen to Iron Maiden on the top 10 at 10 or something like that, right? It was nuts. So that would seem normal to me. Or Kiss or something like that. It was on the radio.
Right.
Nuts, right? So that became the music that I grew up kind of learning how to play. And so my writing was indicative to what I was hearing. So records that blew me away, like were Mutt Lange Productions, like Def Leppard or something, or AC/DC. And so when I got into production, I was like, oh, wow. Like if I could make records that sound like Mutt Lange or something like that. So again, that informs you of what direction you're going into and what you aspire to do or be or sound like. And so you're kind of a product of that.
Absolutely.
So if I was born 5 years earlier or 5 years later, it would have been something very different.
Yeah. Like with me, again, it was kind of that grunge scene as well. I was listening to a lot of Chili Peppers and Incubus and Soundgarden, but also the Britpop stuff. So there's Radiohead and Coldplay. And
Oasis. And that's Oasis. So different from... Yeah, that's what I mean.
But then my brothers, my brothers are around your age.
Yeah.
So I had all that music as well. So
yeah, perfect example, right? You're being exposed to it because that's what they're being exposed to, because that's what all their friends are listening to.
Yeah, exactly.
And it just happens to be because you were born at a certain time.
Yeah, exactly. And then if I go back and it's like my dad's listening to Dean Martin and Marty Robbins. And,
the cool hip guys in that era.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Okay, so before we go, usually I do this rapid kind of random question thing.
Oh, boy.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions here to wrap it up.
All right,
here we go. Okay, so what is one of your favorite memories from performing in Japan? Does anything sort of stick out?
Yeah, I mean, the first time we ever played in Japan, the first show we ever did, the audiences there are notoriously quiet.
Okay.
Like before you play. So there is a curtain, from the stage. They just say, okay, you're on. So we go up, the curtain's up, so we can't see anybody. And we just walk on the stage. It's deathly quiet. Deathly quiet. I don't even know how big the place is. I had no idea. All of a sudden, the curtain drops. We start our intro tape rolls. The curtain drops. The place is absolutely packed. It's sold out. And they lose their mind from deathly silent. And so we finish our first song. And nobody told me this. Nobody warned me. The minute we stopped the first song, we ran into the second one. So there was no dead air there. The minute that one... Song two's over, deadly silent again. There's nothing. And I'm like,
oh, like no applause, no cheering. No.
It was just weird. It was kind of like, I don't even know how to describe it. And then later on after the show, I'm like, wow, that was bizarre. And we're talking to them and we're like, oh, no. They loved it. They're being respectful to you that now that the song is over, that you might be speaking to them and they want to be silent and respectful and listen to what you have to say and not be making noise over you. And I'm like, oh, that's fucking weird.
Yeah,
you
know? So different from North America.
So different, yeah. So I that was probably the coolest memory of hitting the stage in Japan. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
First concert you ever went to when you were young?
I think my first concert ever was Max Webster.
Sweet.
Yeah, Max Webster in Oshawa.
The Schwa.
Yeah, because I grew up in Ajax Whitby area. And so the Schwa was a big venue for, you know, I didn't know the difference between a Canadian act or an American. Like,
course,
I didn't know.
Yeah.
I was just like, I was into this. And another one that I loved and I was into was April Wine. I think was probably my second concert that I saw. I was probably like 12, 13 years old. And went to an April Wine concert. Blew my mind. And then later on, you know, we ended up touring Canada with April Wine. On our Mood Swings tour, actually, we did. We did half the country with April Wine.
That's
amazing. Yeah, which was really cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What's a food or dish you just absolutely hate?
Hate?
Is there like a just...
What have I never had? Like, there's some things where I just know I'm going to hate it, so I've never even tried
it. Oh, really?
So I'll just say that I hate... Like, I've never had a Brussels sprout in my life.
You know what? You might be sleeping on the sprout.
That's what people tell me, but see, I'm just like, I just look at it and go... I'm not going to eat that. Right. See, but I was like that with sushi for a long time. And, you know, we've been to Japan like 23, 24 times, right?
You've had
and
sushi probably, there, obviously, right?
Well, here's the weird thing. The first 10 years of me going to Japan, I wouldn't touch it. I wouldn't touch sushi because, you know, when you're younger, you look at things, you go, I'm not going to eat that.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way. And then fell in love with sushi and then it was the thing. But I found it probably 10 years too late into my trips to Asia.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Missed out on some fantastic meals.
I did. But I made up for it, though.
Yeah,
and I still am.
Favorite childhood show when you were growing up?
Like TV show?
Yeah, TV show.
Oh, God.
Welcome back, Carter.
all the silly sitcoms. I would watch like Gilligan's Island and Welcome Back, Carter was a good one.
And Harum Scarum was from Bugs Bunny,
Bugs
right?
Bunny. Oh, yeah. I used to watch cartoons. Yeah. As a kid watching cartoons. Yeah, Bugs Bunny was a favorite. Yeah, always been a big cartoon fan. Still am. Family Guy.
Oh, yeah.
Simpsons. Yeah.
I'm a big Pixar guy. Funny road story? Anything that comes to mind?
I don't know. Like
that you can share with
me? Yeah, the ones that come to mind are not usually ones that you kind of repeat. But I don't know. You know what? Nothing specific. I mean, it was always just weird buffoonery. Like being in a band is just so bizarre, you know? Again, it's funny when you're younger and like you're in your even 20s and 30s to a certain point. But then it becomes something that's just a chore as you get older.
Yeah.
If you're not doing it at a certain level, I'm sure flying around in a jet, if you're U2, is like a different ball game.
Sure.
But like if you're 40 and 50 and, you know, still traveling around in a van and like, you
bad
know,
back,
sleeping
bad
and
knees.
Shit. Yeah. I mean, I've slept in even recently, like, you know, I was in a hotel in Italy that looked like there had been a murder. There was literally blood on the sheets that I'm sleeping on.
I'm
just like, what is this?
Rock
you know,
roll,
like,
baby.
Yeah, at a certain point in your life, you're like, okay, enough of this. You really need to do well enough to kind of avoid falling into that trap and being in that situation. So, yeah, I mean, there's too many stories to even begin to tell. But, like, yeah, let's say murder sheets, murder room slept in. I've woken up and looked.
Murder sheets.
Yeah, I've seen cockroaches on the floor and stuff like that. Yeah, way more in my younger days.
Pet peeve, just a general pet peeve, anything that just pisses you off. How much time we got?
Yeah, well, you know what? Like, you know, God bless everybody, but, you know, the delusion of a lot of artists is just like, you know, you got to believe in yourself, obviously, and you got to go against the grain and you got to, you know, fight the good fight every day and do things that other people think that you shouldn't be attempting to do. But like, I have way too many conversations with delusional artists that are just like, they're just clearly not good by any metric or any standard. And they're just going to town. And like, you know, the older you get, again, from my perspective, like if I'm talking to you and you're 50 and you've never had any luck at this, you might want to reexamine.
There might be a plan B in play here.
Might be something going awry in the talent department. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. So lastly, I have a lot of like artists and young artists that listen to the pod that just want some guidance as well. So is there any advice that you would give or a good piece of advice or anything that someone might have shared with you along the way when you were getting started?
Yeah, I think, you know, you just got to keep doing what you're doing. And I mean, it sounds cliche and stupid, but you know, every time you write a song or you finish a recording or you do a mix or whatever it is, if you're analytical about it and you're looking to get better, then you will, you know, and it's a slow process. But getting from A to B, there's a reason why people that make records typically aren't 12-year-olds. You know, like you need to put in some time is really what the point is. So you have to be patient and you have to keep working on the craft. And if it doesn't happen overnight, don't be surprised. But, you know, I think you have to be your hardest critic. I mean, it would be the best advice is like, don't finish the song unless it's amazing because you're just wasting your time. Move on. Try again and just keep the standards high because the rest of the world will judge you quite harshly.
Absolutely.
And you got to remember that when you're finishing a song, does the world really need to hear this? Is it really that good?
Right.
And is it better than what's on the radio right now if you're trying to compete in that world? Because most of the time it's not. And people waste a lot of time finishing things that they shouldn't finish. And, you know.
There's a lot of like young artists I'll work with, well, they'll write, say, three songs.
Yeah.
And they think it's amazing. And they want to go in the studio and record. And I always suggest, like, hey, man, like, write 20, 30, you know, like really give yourself a body of work.
Yeah, don't be in a hurry to fail.
Exactly, right? Well, that's awesome. Harry, it's so great to catch up with you again,
awesome.
Man.
Good seeing
and,
you.
I really do appreciate you coming on the pod. Everybody, we're going to be back next week. And thanks so much for listening, guys. Cheers.